loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, according to the Associated Press, the Trump administration leaked today that it will send 800 troops to the border with Mexico in advance of the arrival of the migrant caravan from Central America. These active duty members of the U.S. Army and Air Force will join 2,100 National Guardsmen already on the border. President Trump said that, absent the military, quote, it would be impossible to protect our border, unquote. Next, in a stunning prediction, Ben Hodges, the commander of U.S. forces in Europe from 2014 to 2017, told an audience at the Warsaw Security Forum that there is, quote, a very strong likelihood that we will be at war with China within 15 years, unquote. What can the world do to avert such a catastrophic conflict? Then, type the words Erdogan slams into Google and you'll get a long list, including the US, the UN, the EU, France, Germany, and the Netherlands. Compare that to the Turkish president's latest statement about Saudi Arabia, which is, quote, I have no reason to doubt the king's honesty, unquote. He's referring to the Saudi murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Saudi Arabia's Davos in the Desert Investment Summit has just finished, with billions of dollars in new investment being planned for the kingdom. Erdogan understands that. Why let the death of one journalist get in the way of Turkey's share of the profits? And then the New York Stock Exchange and the Nasdaq have experienced extreme volatility over the past week, with daily swings of as much as 5%. Indeed, the markets are down so much this week that the entire year's gains have been wiped out. What accounts for this volatility? And is it temporary, or is it something we should get used to? And finally, there was a debate last night in Florida between the two gubernatorial candidates, Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum and Congressman Ron DeSantis. Actually, it was less of a debate than it was a bare-knuckle brawl. DeSantis said that Gillum as governor would allow pedophiles to have free rein in Florida, and Gillum said that DeSantis was the candidate of neo-Nazis and white supremacists. In the meantime, news broke that the FBI had earlier tried to set up Gillum on a criminal charge by giving him free tickets to the musical Hamilton. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the border. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis is expected to sign an order sending at least 800 U.S. troops to the U.S.-Mexico border as a caravan of thousands of migrants heads north from Central America. These active-duty members of the U.S. Army and Air Force will join 2,100 National Guardsmen already on the border. President Trump said that, absent the military, quote, it would be impossible to protect our border, unquote. We're joined from Tucson, Arizona by Isabel Garcia, co-founder of Coalición de Derechos Humanos. Welcome back, Isabel.
Thank you for having me.
Isabel, what exactly would military troops be doing on the U.S. border? Is that legal?
Well, let me tell you, I think... First of all, we have to have a backdrop here that we have the Posse Comitatus Act. In this country, we have laws that say very explicitly that armed forces are not to be involved in the enforcement of civil law, civilian law. We've actually gone to Congress in decades past where the military has agreed with us that they have no place along the border because they are trained to kill. Of course, everything has changed and, you know, now they're very willing, but it is a violation of the Posse Comitatus Act. That is what I submit to people, that we should be very frightened, that we are now being scared out of our wits so that we say, yes, yes, send the army. We have to understand that migration is still lower than when I graduated from high school in 1971. We can see images that, you know, we've never seen before, and there's many more in the caravan that have been in years past. This has been going on for almost 20 years because of social media and because of the desperation being felt in those Central American countries. And so rather than seeing it as a military issue, I mean, it's outrageous that we are responding in a militaristic fashion when these are desperate human beings, families, children, grandparents, everybody moving north out of desperation. And many of us say, well, you know, how is that our fault? And I think this is where we have to step back and understand that we are supporting a horrific illegal government in Honduras, Hernandez. And those people from Honduras, and the majority of them are from Honduras, are coming because they are feeling the desperation, the violence of that illegitimate government that only the United States of America chooses to prop up and to legitimize. So this is a humanitarian crisis. And a few thousand people, when you look at our absorption rate in this country of the millions that we are, even very conservative columnist has agreed that, oh, come on, you guys, we can't assimilate all these people. I just heard another expert say Central Americans in particular are a huge boom to our economy. I mean, those things are not being said. And in fact, it's all a fear-mongering situation. It's just impossible that we are going to allow this. I just can't believe that as Americans, we're going to allow the use of military forces along our border. Do not allow yourselves to believe that we're being invaded and that it's frightening. It's a lie. We've had a border with Mexico ever since we invaded Mexico. We took half its land, and we've had a border with Mexico that has permitted for the millions and millions that we have recruited, in particular from Mexico, to come and work, to pick our fields, to build the railroads. I mean, all of these things are historical facts. So we really need to stop ourselves in this midst of fear. And we need to look at history, that the worst authoritarian despots, dictators come about when they scare the population. And that's what we're facing right now. I mean, the fear of brown people coming from Central America is outrageous. It really is, because people that are desperate and willing to work and do everything they can to just survive and give, you know, some peace and safety to their families should not be seen as an invading army. And that's what President Trump is urging us to do. And that's what he's doing.
Isabel Garcia is our guest. We're talking to Isabel from Tucson about the announcement, the media announcement, that James Mattis, Secretary of Defense, is about to sign an order sending 800 U.S. active duty Army personnel to the border to join with the 2,100 already present National Guards people. John, this is the U.S. Army being used as a political prop.
Yes.
I mean, let's just call it for what it is. This is not a military threat. The migrants who are coming, who the Trump administration and the Republicans are using as a convenient sort of optic for the midterm elections, you know, to beat them up, to conjure up the idea of the hordes coming from the South. Mm-hmm. These troops are going there to stop them. Well, they're not going to be crashing through the border. If they came, they would come to the border, and then they would begin a process of asylum application. They're not rushing the barricades of the fence or the border. They're not armed.
That's right. This is a longstanding process that they would enter into.
This is using American soldiers as a political prop, because if you use the Army, then it feeds into the narrative, we are at war, we are threatened, and thus we must rely on our armed forces to keep us safe. I mean, let's face it. This is the most cynical, the most odious, the most disgusting, and I would say the most racist use. Not that there haven't been other exercises in these same things, but it is right up there, the most racist use of the U.S. soldiers who are paid for by American taxpayers for the political ends of Donald Trump. That's all this is.
Well, Donald Trump tweeted at 4:05 a.m. I want to ask Isabel about this tweet. He says, Brandon Judd of the National Border Patrol Council is right when he says on Fox and Friends that the Democrat-inspired laws make it tough for us to stop people at the border. Must be changed. But I am bringing out the military for this national emergency. They will be stopped! Exclamation point. What is he talking about, Democrat-inspired laws?
Inspired laws. It's an outrage. It's to feed the narrative that somehow this is related to our immigration laws, when in fact people are coming out of desperation. What we ought to see is what Democrats and Republicans together have done to create conditions in Honduras, where people feel compelled to make this journey. That's what Brandon Judd, we know Brandon Judd, these guys feed on creating bigger and bigger and bigger institutions till they're in total control. Border Patrol and police unions want to be in control, and I believe they don't have a role in civil governance. They have their own, the role that civil governance gives to them. And right now, I feel a huge conflict of interest where they just want to be in control of now even the narrative. Very dangerous for all Americans to understand that we're being used in this fear when, again, look at who's coming up, people who are desperate, desperate families.
I'm always amused when the president criticizes Democrats for somehow blocking his agenda when the Republicans control the White House, they control the House of Representatives, and they control the Senate. And the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has used the so-called nuclear option to essentially do away with the filibuster. So the Republicans can literally do anything they want right now. Anything they want. Somehow this is the Democrats' fault. And I'm not a Democrat. I'm not saying this because I'm, you know, a partisan Democrat. I'm not. I'm just saying it strains.
They're facts. What they're stating, they're statements that this is Democratic inspired. I mean, they are so, I mean, it is so cynical that they're just using it for the election to create fear. Look at the hordes. They're brown. They're different. And the Democrats support them. That's it. That's it. I mean, they just repeat that over and over and over again. They know that's their MO.
Isabel, let's talk real quick. We just have a little bit of time left. Why is the caravan so much bigger this year than it has been in the past? And as you said, it's been going on each year for a long time, or maybe not annually, but periodically for a long time.
Yeah, it's been going on for a long time. I believe the caravan has grown mainly. The number one reason is the social media. You would not believe it, the publicity it's been given, and people who are thinking about migrating because, you know, the teenage daughter is being eyed by the cartel as a sex slave, or the son is going to be, you know, told to carry drugs or whatever. They want to leave. And when they hear that there's going to be a group that where you can travel in safety, that's why people are really rushing to this. And secondly, I want to say, are the conditions in Honduras that we as the United States continue to perpetuate and his hollow threats of or meaningless threats of taking away aid that has been used against the very migrants themselves, because most of this aid is in the form of police and security. Why doesn't he say, I'm sending 1,000 social workers, doctors, and other behavioral health people and food to the border?
I fear those are words that we just simply will never hear coming from Donald Trump. We'll have to leave it there, though. We were joined from Tucson, Arizona by Isabel Garcia, co-founder of Coalición de Derechos Humanos. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
In a stunning prediction, Ben Hodges, the commander of U.S. forces in Europe from 2014 to 2017, told an audience at the Warsaw Security Forum that, quote, there is a very strong likelihood that we will be at war with China, unquote, within 15 years. What can the world do to avert such a catastrophic conflict? We're joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News producer and analyst. Walter, welcome back.
Happy to be here.
Walter, I find it shocking that someone with those three shiny stars on his shoulder, who until very, very recently was the commander of U.S. forces in Europe, to make such a bold and violent prediction. What's behind this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's perhaps it's not shocking that the United States and its top military leaders are preparing for war with China. But I think what is truly shocking is that he would be willing to say that at a major security conference. You know, I was looking at the list of speakers at this Warsaw Security Conference. You know, that Jens Stoltenberg, the former Secretary General of NATO, was speaking there. The Polish foreign minister, lots of like top level officials. So this is a very high profile gathering. And yeah, he said, in 15 years, we're going to have to fight in the Pacific. And I mean, China is a nuclear armed country. The United States obviously is a nuclear armed country as well. This could be, you know, a truly catastrophic. Catastrophic is almost an understatement.
The United States fought China once. It was between 1950 and 53.
Yes, that's true.
Tens of thousands of Americans died.
Mm-hmm.
The Chinese entered the Korean War on the side of the North Korean military forces, Korean People's Army, and armed guerrilla forces that were trying to repel the Americans and the other 25 nations that were part of the UN contingent that invaded Korea on June 27th, 1950. A million Chinese died, Walter. A million, perhaps more.
Including Mao's son, I think.
Including Mao Zedong's son. You know, Americans don't remember this. They don't remember that this was not that long ago. And here you have these maniacs, also known as the Pentagon High Command, saying, hey, everybody, let's get ready, saying it cavalierly as if it's just a given and without real explanation about why this is happening. I mean, isn't it like considered going to war against a major power like China, which is not only a nuclear power, but has 1.3 billion human beings, one out of every four on the planet are Chinese. I mean, wouldn't that be considered like a major thing that you'd want to debate and discuss beforehand? I mean, it's just shocking.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And it shows how undemocratic the whole nature of U.S. foreign and military policy is. I mean, no, if you ask somebody, anybody in the United States, you know, hey, do you think that there should be a war between the U.S. and China? I think almost everybody will say no, because they understand that, you know, one, the people who are going to be doing the fighting and dying are, you know, ordinary people. Two, it could end the world, right? I mean, it's so bad, and it strikes, I think, any reasonable person as just the worst possible thing that could happen. But to these generals, it's like no big deal. It's just like, you know, taken, like you said, you know, it's just taken as a given.
You know, John Kiriakou, Foreign Affairs Magazine, which is the mouthpiece of the Council of Foreign Relations,
yes,
which at one time was the place where foreign policy was determined in Washington. That's no longer
the
case.
It really was. And now it's a place for bankers and millionaires and billionaires to sit around and pretend that they make foreign policy.
Right. But nonetheless, it's a little window.
Oh,
like,
yes.
Like Hodge's comments are a window into the contemporary thinking of the Washington elites. Here's today's headline from Foreign Affairs Magazine, the mouthpiece of Council on Foreign Relations. Okay, do you have your seatbelt on?
Uh-oh.
Okay. Beijing's nuclear option, subtitle, why a U.S.-Chinese war could spiral out of control. I mean, really? Wouldn't just having the war be an indication that things have spun out of control? I mean, the whole assumption here is that a war is coming, but we have to make sure it's a good war with China, that it shouldn't spiral out of control. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. And it shows that, you know, this is part of the whole reorientation of U.S. foreign policy. You know, this idea of great power competition replacing the, you know, so-called war on terrorism that was the dominant theme of U.S., you know, actions around the world for the past 10, 15 years. Yeah, you know, they know, the U.S. knows that their hegemony is in jeopardy. They haven't lost their hegemony in the world, but it's in jeopardy because they're rising powers. And well, they identify Russia as one of the two sort of great power competitors. The one that I think they're really worried about is China. I mean, China has, you know, an extremely fast growing economy. It can, you know, in the near future, rival the United States for economic preeminence. The, you know, like you said, there's 1.3 billion people in China. You know, it's a country that has enormous economic and military potential. But I reject the idea that China is some great threat to the people of the United States. I mean, I don't think that China's foreign policy is oriented towards global domination like the United States is, right? I mean, it's about, you know, making sure that it can move up the value-added chain, or right, in the global production chain. So that's what, you know, like the Made in China 2025 thing is about. It's about going from a country that is involved in low-level manufacturing to one that has, you know, a vibrant middle class and a strong economy. It's not about, you know, this global order. They're not trying to set up, you know, things like NATO. They're not trying to set up things like, you know, the IMF or the World Bank. You know, they do things like the Belt and Road Initiative, but I don't think that comes with the same type of, you know, strings attached policies that U.S. economic deals do.
The Foreign Affairs article that I was mentioning has under the very, very, very clever subtitle called Straight Shooters, and straight is spelled S-T-R-A-I-T, meaning the Taiwan Straits.
Oh, I get it.
You get it? It's very clever. And they explain, Walter, how the war could happen. Why would we, you know, let's have the Third World War.
Well, let me ask you a question then, because you're an expert on East Asia. Why would we want to fight a war with China? What could we possibly have to gain from a war with China?
Yeah, and the big question, the big thing, the word I would highlight there is the word we. Because right. If you're talking about we, like the American people,
yeah,
like regular working people in America, we don't want to fight China.
No.
No one does. If you took a poll right now and said to all of, like, quote, average people in America, would you like to have a war with China? I think we'd get like a 99%. There'd be like that 1% of, like, I don't know how you describe them, but not in good shape people. But here's the quote from the Foreign Affairs. The most worrisome flashpoint for a U.S.-Chinese war is Taiwan. Beijing's long-term objective of reunifying the island with mainland China is clearly in conflict with Washington's long-standing desire to maintain the status quo in the strait. It is not difficult to imagine how this might lead to war. So here we're talking, John and Walter, about a possibility of a third world war. The second one took the lives of 85 million people. This one will be worse, right? Mm-hmm. And why is it going to happen? Because of Taiwan? Because China wants to reunify a part of China called Taiwan, the island of Taiwan that's been part of China for four centuries, that they want to reunify it, and the world could go to World War III over their desire to reunify with a part of their own seized territory, with Washington's desire to maintain the status quo? I mean, come on. I mean, this is this kind of euphemistic cavalier talk masks just what must be understood is just downright, clearly observable imperialism as the driving force for American military doctrine.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And the reason why they're willing to entertain the notion of a nuclear war with China over Taiwan is that, you know, it's like the domino theory during the Cold War. You know, if we give them an inch, then they're going to take a mile. You know, we can't give them anything at all, even if it's something, you know, as you said, is rightfully recognized as part of their own country. Because, you know, the goal of the United States is to encircle China, right? So to deploy their military assets to the Pacific, to build alliances with India, Australia, and Japan, the so-called Indo-Pacific Quad, to sort of box in China. And Taiwan is part of that, too. I mean, Taiwan is this heavily, heavily armed by U.S. corporations, you know, sort of garrison state. They see it in a dagger pointed at China.
John, when you think back in history, the American people didn't want to go to war even against Japan when Japan was on the march, you know, in terms of reclaiming most of Asia as its own colonial possessions. It took Pearl Harbor.
That's right. And in fact, the American government and the American people were actually famous for their distaste for international armed conflict.
So you had the Japanese Air Force coming and attacking an American naval base in Hawaii at Pearl Harbor. Thousands of American soldiers, sailors were killed. And then FDR could easily get a declaration of war, the last time one was asked for and and ascertained. But over the Strait of Taiwan, I mean, this is not the bombing of American military installations. I just don't see how the American people would agree to this kind of concept that's being cavalierly talked about by Hodges, former military leader, and these think tanks from the Washington elites, these neocon think tanks. But what we are engaged in is the beginning of a public relations campaign to get the American people to acclimate to this ridiculous, crazy concept. Walter, 30 seconds left.
Well, I just, the last thing maybe to point out is that Hodges, you know, when he was the commander of U.S. troops in Europe, he took over in, I believe it was November of 2014. That was after the crisis in Ukraine and Crimea when, you know, the really, really bad tensions between the West and Russia, you know, started. It had been deteriorating up until that point, but it got really, really bad after that. And so, you know, he's now not only a fan of world war with China, but, you know, his actions, I think, objectively, when he was in that very high post, highly increased the likelihood of conflict with Russia, too.
Well, we were very happy to be joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's one of the producers of this show and a Sputnik News analyst. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Type the words Erdogan slams into Google and you get a long list, including the US, the UN, the EU, France, Germany, and the Netherlands. Compare that to the Turkish president's latest statement about Saudi Arabia, which is, quote, "I have no reason to doubt the king's honesty," unquote. He's referring to the Saudi murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Saudi Arabia's so-called Davos in the Desert investment summit has just finished with billions of dollars in new investment being planned for the kingdom. Erdogan understands that. So why let the death of one journalist get in the way of Turkey's share of the profits? We're joined from Tehran by Mohammed Mirandi. He's an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature, and he teaches at the University of Tehran. Mohammed, it's always good to have you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Mohammed, this is more than just money and investment and Turkey's share of the money and the investment. This is about regional strength and regional domination, is it not? The Turks and the Saudis have been on opposite sides of a lot of different issues, whether it's Syria or the uprising in Egypt or Iran, frankly. What do you think is the actual point of these statements between the Saudis and the Turks?
Well, there is an issue of principle. I don't think that it's fair to say that Turkey is completely cynical and they're simply out to get money or investment from the Saudis. But obviously, the geopolitics that we have been witnessing over the past few years is extraordinarily important. Turkey and Saudi Arabia are rivals. They are hostile towards each other. They've been allies for a while over Syria, and then they parted ways. The Saudis supported the coup in Turkey. Their media were celebrating during the night of the coup, and only roughly 16 hours after it failed, they did the Saudi media come out and recognize or support the legitimate government. So there is there are a host of issues. The issue of Qatar, and of course, Turkey has good relations with Iran, except for on the issue of Syria, where they had sharp differences. But that's decreasing, especially after the coup and after Syrian reversals for Turkey. So it's a complicated situation right now. The hostility that exists, I think, is we see it every day in this Turkish media. And in the Saudi media, but recently, literally within hours, the Saudi crown prince has both given some sort of praise towards Qatar and its economic achievements in his speech at the Davos of the desert, as it's called. And he also praised the Turks, despite the fact that he's been largely he's been attacked relentlessly by the Turkish media. And he had a conversation with the Turkish prime minister, or the Turkish president, Mr. Erdogan, as well. So we have to see where things go. It's getting very interesting, but we have to see what happens.
Yeah, it's getting very complicated, it seems to me. And that makes me want to come back to the issue of Khashoggi. This is a terrible violation of protocol to murder, for one country to murder somebody on the soil of another country. The Saudis denied this for 2 weeks and then finally just in the last 4 days have said, okay, sure, he was murdered, but we had no idea that these rogues were going to do such a thing. Well, this is something that greatly angers the Turks. So how do the Saudis and the Turks settle this? Because somebody's going to have to pay some sort of a price.
That's the biggest question. I don't have the answer. And even, you know, if there is a deal, it's difficult to define what a deal even means.
Right.
So some say the Turks and the Saudis will ultimately do a deal, but that's not an easy thing to define. right now it's obvious that the Saudis are backing down. We hear that Jamal's son is, apparently he's left the country. We know that now the prosecutor, the Saudi prosecutor, is saying that this was the intention from the start was to kill Jamal. But of course, he's not going to. He will obviously say that it was a rogue attack by these 15 Saudi officials and whoever Saudi Arabia was behind it. But definitely not Mohammed bin Salman from the Saudi official perspective. So we do see the Saudis stepping back and Mohammed bin Salman behaving much more in a much more humble fashion than before in his speech at the so-called Davos in the desert conference. It's hard to say, but I don't think that this is going to go away. This I think is important. I don't think that Mohammed bin Salman can recover.
Well, that was actually my next question to you was, is he going to be able to recover? Is he going to be able to maintain his position within the family? Or should we expect to see a threat to him from within the family? His father is elderly. His father is ill. There's not a lot of time before Mohammed bin Salman becomes king. And there is a precedent for deposing a crown prince or even a king in the case of King Saud in the early 1960s. So what happens then? Has Mohammed bin Salman bitten off more than he can chew? Has he put his position in jeopardy?
And Mohammed, before you answer that, when I'm reading the Wall Street Journal today, it's the same article. The headline is changing. But the headline that's in the hard copy says, Saudis aim to ease tension over deaths. And then they quote Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and said, the incident that took place is very painful to all Saudis. It's a hideous incident and totally unjustifiable. A Western official based in the Persian Gulf said Prince Mohammed was delivering a message, quote, the Turks and us can find an agreement, close quote. Quote, they had no choice, the official said, referring to the Saudis. They are in a corner and they have to be conciliatory. They can't afford to fight back. The U.S. has taken diplomatic actions, including visa revocations against 21 Saudi officials it believes were involved in the journalist killing. The prince said, meaning Mohammed bin Salman, he won't let, or Saudis won't let the incident, quote, drive a wedge, close quote, between Turkey, one of the region's most powerful military forces, and Saudi Arabia, quote, this wedge won't take place. And the article goes on, Mohammed, to suggest not only will there be an agreement between Saudis and Turkey and one that the United States will favor because the Trump administration favors the continuance in power of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, but that the Crown Prince is in fact not feeling that endangered on the home front, that he's got enough support on the home front. Anyway, we have 3 minutes, so I've taken a little bit too much time, but I want you to really sort of probe into this issue that you have been saying for the last couple of days, which is you don't actually believe after all of this that Mohammed bin Salman will continue, maybe not immediately, but over time.
Yes, he's been weakened too much. He is not credible. He's not going to be traveling to any foreign country as a head of state without the media reminding everyone what he's done. No one will be interested in having photo opportunities with him, no credible person. Within the country, he's been hurt very badly. I just think it's a matter of time. I don't know what will happen, but there's too many powers that have influence in Saudi Arabia. If the Americans and the British want him removed, they have a lot of influence among the armed forces. Many of the key figures have been trained by the British or the Americans. Inside the country, the king is obviously wants to preserve his son. But if the king dies, then he no longer has that cover. He no longer has the cover of the king. And I'm sure that he no longer feels secure even among his own people, because if these 18 people are sacrificed, then that sends a message to everyone that, look, he's not going to protect you. Even if you're loyal to him, he will throw you under the bus whenever the time comes. So I don't think he any longer has credibility abroad or at home, nor does he feel safe and secure. That's, you know, that he may last for a few weeks, a few months, a couple of years, but this is no longer the Mohammed bin Salman that we know, that we've known. And this is no longer the Saudi Arabia that we knew. And the Turks, even if they do some sort of deal, whatever that means, they will still have this tape. And I think once this tape is leaked, whenever, that will be devastating for the Saudi regime.
I have to agree completely. It reminds me very much of a mafia family where the boss is the boss and loyalty only goes one way. But then at the end of the day, somebody else wants to be the boss. There's no real loyalty moving up and he's removed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is the difference between Mohammed bin Salman and the Saudi family before. Before, there was consensus. They ruled together. Whatever happened, happened. Now, this man has cut everyone else out, and he's hurt himself at home and abroad. He has no loyal people anymore because those who are loyal to him are disappear. So this is not a mafia chief that is... you can bet on.
I think you're right. That was the voice of Mohammed Mirandi. He joined us from Tehran. Mohammed is a professor and an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and we'll come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ Stock Exchange have experienced extreme volatility over the past week with daily swings of as much as 5%. Indeed, the markets were down so much this week that the entire year's gains have been wiped out. What accounts for this volatility? And is it temporary or is it something that we all have to get used to? We're joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He's a financial policy analyst. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, we've recorded this show at about 1:20 p.m. on Thursday.
East Coast time.
East Coast time, Thursday, October 25th. And the markets at this point are the Dow Jones is up 271.5 points. The NASDAQ is up 159.25 points. And the S&P 500 is up 37.25 points. These really are dramatic swings. I mean, when you've got a swing of 5%, just to put it into perspective, a correction is 10%. And sometimes corrections take months to play out. These are playing out in just a matter of days. Why is this happening?
Yeah, the volatility is tied to a number of things. I think that one of the most important things that we need to look at on kind of a macro scale is that the current administration, the Trump administration, is upending, you know, nearly about 70 years of U.S. policy on global trade and global economics. Without going into too much detail, post-World War II, the United States saw this dream of having this global integrated capitalist empire with the United States at the middle, where trade flowed without state intervention, without tariffs, without regulations, where capital was king, and it would kind of spread throughout the globe. The Trump administration is confounding that vision and is instituting policies that are inconsistent with it. The biggest one right now is the tariff war against China, but against many other longtime U.S. allies in Europe as well. And that is creating a tremendous amount of uncertainty where investors aren't really sure exactly where things are going to go. And the reason why we're seeing it bounce around is they're basically deciding or trying to decide whether they think these economic changes are going to be profitable in some respects or if they're going to hurt things. And I think they are of a divided mind. Some are deeply concerned that this will hurt their ability to profit, hurt their ability to accumulate capital, and some see it as a potential opportunity. And so you see the prices bouncing around. On the tail of that is the Fed's decision to start raising interest rates, which Trump has been very publicly against.
Oh, boy,
and has attacked
it.
The Fed. Yeah, yes, viciously. And the reason why is he's not stupid. He knows that raising treasury prices will cause a lot of capital to flow out of the stock indices like the Dow Jones and the NASDAQ and into these treasuries, because now that raise in rates will produce more profit. Treasuries are more stable, they're more safe, and investors are eager to hedge their bets and get some of their money into a more safe investment. And that's what treasuries are being, which is why he's attacking the Fed for raising the rates. He wants to keep them low so he can artificially divert all that capital into the stock markets and keep them at this bloated, overinflated pricing that they've had really, you know, ever since the kind of bailout of the banks when the acceleration of the stock market started.
And what should investors, small investors, be looking to do here? I mean, what do? You short stocks? Do you move to bonds? Do you ride it out? most people, not most people, but a lot of Americans would panic. A lot of Americans would buy high and sell low and then kick themselves for getting into a volatile market. But what should they be doing?
Yeah, I mean, I would be hesitant to offer a whole bunch of stock advice on the radio, because the truth is this volatility shows that uncertainty. If these big hedge funds and investors aren't really sure exactly where things are going to go, the little guy certainly isn't going to know.
Yeah, he's not going to know.
Right. And the little guy, though, has a lot to lose. You know, if you're investing in a hedge fund, you have millions and millions of dollars. If you lose some of your value, 10%, 20%, you're going to be okay. Nobody's going to go hungry. Whereas little guys can go hungry, can wipe out their savings, can lose everything. And so this sort of stuff is naturally very frightening because they have a significant amount of, you know, money in the game. I think that this volatility, this air being let out of the tire is going to continue. I think the indices will continue to go down. They'll bounce around some. You know, shorting stock prices and engaging in futures and stuff like that is highly sophisticated trading. It's complex. It's difficult. Very well-capitalized investment firms do it and make a lot of money, but little guys typically cannot. It's a very hard thing to do, and you could lose your shirt very quickly. So, you know, I don't really see that as a particular option. I think really in the end, whether it bounces down or it bounces up, these large firms and large investors will be fine. They'll make money off of derivatives or short sales or futures or just from buying the stocks themselves. And the little guy will have to risk a whole lot more and won't get access to nearly as sophisticated instruments. So that's my take on it. I think it will continue to go down as the money moves out of these markets into treasuries as investors seek more stable investments.
Daniel Sankey is our guest. We're talking about the extreme volatility in the stock market. Yesterday, lost over 600 points in the Dow Jones Industrial Average, wiped out all the gains of 2018. Bouncing back so far today as we pre-record this segment in early afternoon, a little bit after 1 o'clock East Coast time. I'm looking at the Wall Street Journal editorial from today. Now, the Wall Street Journal editorial board supports Donald Trump. They are right-wing, all about Donald Trump's tax plan. In general, almost everything Donald Trump has said they like. But here's the headline from today's editorial. Trump flunks Fed politics. Bashing Jay Powell makes it harder to keep interest rates low. Now, Jay Powell is, in fact, the Powell who Donald Trump named, appointed to be the replacement of Yellen at the Federal Reserve. But I want to read to you a couple sentences and then get your reaction. Donald J. Trump is a real estate man, so naturally he prefers low interest rates. But he's also president. And publicly mau-mauing the Federal Reserve to keep rates low, as he has been doing, will lead to the opposite of what he wants. This is Fed Politics 101. Quote, every time we do something great, he raises the interest rates, close quote, Mr. Trump said Tuesday in an interview with our Journal colleagues, referring to Fed Chairman Jay Powell. Quote, he was supposed to be a low interest rate guy. It's turned out that he's not. Now, then the editorial goes on and says Steve Mnuchin, the Secretary of the Treasury, was the one who told Donald Trump to select Powell as the chairman of the chief, as the Fed chief. Why? And this is really interesting, because he would be more amenable to political pressure than other possible candidates. And so what the Wall Street Journal is basically saying is that by beating him up publicly, it makes it harder for Powell to do what he's inclined to do, which is basically to function as a stooge on the Federal Reserve for the person who appointed him. And then it goes through all of the different instances in the history of the relationship between the White House and Federal Reserve chairpersons, whereby the White House constantly pressured Federal Reserve chairpersons not to raise interest rates because it would slow the economy. And as a consequence, the incumbent president who appointed that person would be held politically responsible for higher unemployment or higher or lower wages, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, just a crass, pragmatic sort of slap on the hand to Donald Trump for not being smart about how to discipline the Federal Reserve. Quite something.
It is quite something. And I think it's a moment of honesty that you won't usually see in these sort of big ruling class papers, is them basically saying, look, the Fed will do what you want it to. It's an extension of state power. It's a puppet. Its independence is a mirage. But you have to let people think that it's independent and that it's making its own decisions without you. So if you go out there and publicly tell it to do something and it does it, that ruins the idea that it's somehow this objective economic institution, which it most certainly is not. You know, as I mentioned before, the Fed is a powerful political institution. It's used for political aims, ends. It has political gains, and it is largely at the beck and call of state powers. So, you know, I think the Wall Street Journal is kind of honest in where they say, look, Trump, it's going to do whatever you want anyway. It always has. Just, you know, let the little guy think that it has independence and don't be so public about it, because when you are, then the Fed naturally has to push back. But it's all political theater. You know, they go to the same country clubs, their kids go to the same schools. When they see each other in the hall and the office, they shake hands and smile. The truth is that this fight, this confrontation, is a mirage. It's political theater. They're both on the side of billionaires. They're both on the side of the people that Wall Street Journal represents. And they are working together to make their lives as easy as possible and as profitable as possible.
The Wall Street Journal couldn't help itself by using the formulation Mau Mauing. Of course, that's derogatory towards the Mau Mau in East Africa, in Kenya, who were fighting against British imperialism and who were treated in the Western media as like the most extreme terrorists in the world because they actually wanted to reclaim their country for themselves. Daniel Sankey, we absolutely appreciate the idea that you aren't giving advice what people should do with their money. That's very smart, and Loud and Clear doesn't want to do that. But I do want you to sort of in the next 30 seconds, our last 30 seconds, say your own opinion about where we're going big picture, not about what's going to happen today or tomorrow, but what's coming big picture with the economy.
I think big picture with the economy, we're going to see a downturn in stock prices. I think that the volatility will continue and will grow stronger. This administration has a couple more years to go. Trump is not going to back down. He's going to continue with tariffs. He's going to continue with these policies, which create a unstable environment, make it difficult for companies to know how to profit, where they're going to profit. And we're still waiting to see what the heck is going to happen with these tariffs. They're going to have long-term, deep consequences, and we're not totally sure what those are going to be. So in the climate of instability, we're going to see a depression in stock prices. We're going to see investors squirreling their way their money in things that are, quote, safe, like treasuries, commodities, other things like that. And I think we're going to see a tumble down in stock prices in general.
That was the voice of Daniel Sankey. Daniel joined us from San Francisco. He's a financial policy analyst. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. There was a debate last night in Florida between the two gubernatorial candidates. That's Tallahassee Mayor Andrew Gillum and Congressman Ron DeSantis. Actually, it was less of a debate than it was a bare-knuckled brawl. DeSantis said that Gillum as governor would allow pedophiles to have free reign in Florida. And Gillum said that DeSantis was the candidate of neo-Nazis and white supremacists. In the meantime, news broke that the FBI had earlier tried to set up Gillum on a criminal charge by giving him free tickets to the musical Hamilton. We're joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. Walter is one of the producers of this show and a Sputnik News analyst. Good to have you back, Walter.
Yeah, very happy to be here. And this is certainly one of the most interesting races in the country.
Agreed.
Going on right now in 2018. I mean, so there's the debate yesterday, but just introduce, if you would, I guess our listeners to the general race here. I mean, who is DeSantis? Who is Gillum?
Yep. Gillum is the mayor of Tallahassee, Florida. He was a serious underdog in the Democratic primary, and somehow he got out the vote better than anybody else did, and he scored an upset and won the Democratic nomination. Solid progressive, a Bernie Sanders Democrat. The liberals in Florida were thrilled when he won that race. DeSantis is a very conservative Republican congressman. He was one of the first members of Congress to endorse Donald Trump and really has thrown his lot in with Donald Trump more than just about any other gubernatorial candidate anywhere in the country. So there's a real and stark ideological difference between these two candidates. I think that nobody expected this debate to go smoothly. This was the second of two debates, with the election being just a week and a half away. But these guys attacked each other from the opening bell. It was a pretty incredible thing to watch. There was one point where Gillum was kind of baiting DeSantis, because DeSantis was protesting virtually everything that Gillum was saying about him. And Gillum responded by saying this, quote, "Let me first say my grandmother used to say a hit dog will holler, and it hollered through this room. Mr. DeSantis has spoken. He's got neo-Nazis helping him out. I'm not calling him a racist. The racists are calling him a racist." Those are some bold words. What do you think of that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, well, let me ask you, what are the specific things that he's referencing there? I mean, there's the robocalls.
Right. There were these extraordinarily racist robocalls that went out just a few days ago to thousands of Florida voters. Both campaigns have condemned them, and it's really not clear where they came from. The conventional wisdom is that they came from the Ku Klux Klan. But there are campaign volunteers who are avowed neo-Nazis and white supremacists who have been working for the DeSantis campaign, and DeSantis refuses to disavow himself of their support. So that's where the charges of racism are coming from.
Yeah, and I think immediately after Gillum won the primary, so when the general election campaign really got under the way, he said voters shouldn't, quote, monkey this. I mean, it's an obvious racist dog whistle right out the gate, really setting the tone for this whole election campaign.
Yeah, he was referring to an organization that Gillum is associated with called Dream Defenders. It's a progressive organization. It's a social justice group. And in its platform, it has said that the police should be abolished. Okay, that's kind of an extreme position, but you hear that a lot on the harder left. Like you said, though, DeSantis's reaction to this was to say that Gillum was monkeying up the primary and then refused to apologize for it. There's a terrific article in today's Miami Herald, and it's entitled 5 Takeaways from Andrew Gillum and Ron DeSantis's Final Gubernatorial Debate. Number one is, it got ugly and fast. And it did. As I said, virtually from the opening bell, it's a euphemism, I'm really talking about the first question, it really did get ugly. And it just went downhill from there. Now, interesting to me on the Gillum side is these charges of corruption. And they're not really charges per se, as much as hints of corruption. They're specifically about a Hamilton ticket. This is a ticket to the Broadway hit Hamilton. And here's what the Miami Herald says. Gillum faced fresh questions this week over his connections with lobbyist and former friend Adam Corey, who has become a focus of the FBI's public corruption investigation in the capital city. Those questions were fanned Tuesday by the release of hundreds of pages of emails and photos documenting some of Gillum's trips with Corey and meetings with other lobbyists. Among the points of contention has been a New York trip in August 2016, during which FBI undercover agents provided Gillum with tickets to a showing of Hamilton and then took him on a boat tour of New York Harbor. Gillum, in a rare moment of regret, said that he took responsibility, quote, for not having asked more questions, unquote. So Gillum was never charged with a crime. He was never accused of corruption, but he was tied to a corrupt lobbyist. He used some of the fruits of that corruption to see the show, to go on a tour. There were some expensive restaurant meals. Is that sticking?
Well, I mean, it really sounds to me like the FBI is kind of out to get. I mean, that sounds like entrapment. I mean, maybe it doesn't meet the legal standard for entrapment, but if you just, you know, tell that to the average voter, you know, they would probably conclude, well, okay, so maybe this isn't like an act of, you know, overt, or, you know, he wasn't taking the initiative to be corrupt, or, you know, it's like really seems like it's not something that's significant enough to change the race. Although I mean, I think it is telling that the FBI was, you know, taking this type of action against them. And he had, you know, a pretty clever comeback that a lot of people are writing about at the debate. I believe we have a clip of that if we want to take a listen.
In the state of Florida, we got a lot of issues. In fact, we got 99 issues, and Hamilton ain't one of them.
So, yeah, there you go. I mean, just kind of making light of the whole thing. I think that's actually probably a pretty effective strategy. I expect that to kind of work.
I think that's probably right. And voters in Florida have known about this Hamilton ticket situation for the last year and a half. It's not coming out now as a surprise. It's not a last-minute grenade thrown into the middle of the campaign. People know about it. And I think most voters, if these Hamilton tickets are important to them, they've already come down on one side or the other. I want to get back to this issue of racism. The toughest, the most controversial point in this debate last night came not between the two candidates, really, so much as it came between the moderator and DeSantis. The moderator is a fellow by the name of McDermott. He's a journalist in Florida. It says here, one of the most heated moments came not between Gillum and DeSantis, but when McDermott tried to question the Republican nominee about his appearance at a David Horowitz Freedom Center conference, some of whose members have been accused of racism. But before McDermott could finish, DeSantis cut in. And here's what he shouted, and shouted it. He didn't say it. He said, "How the hell am I supposed to know every single statement somebody makes? Let me just say this straight up. I've lived my life, whether it's athletics, military, serving as a prosecutor. When I was downrange in Iraq, we worked as a team regardless of race. But I am not going to bow down to the altar of political correctness. I am not going to let the media smear me as they have done with so many other people."
Okay, so David Horowitz, I mean, it's not a question of like, oh, you know, 20 years ago, David Horowitz said something racist and now they're, you know, just trying to get me with it. It's like David Horowitz's whole thing is being opposed to Muslims. I mean, extreme anti-Muslim bigotry is his whole political brand. And, you know, he works with other loathsome figures on the far right, like Pam Geller. In fact, when I was in college, he, you know, came to give a speech about, you know, the dangers of radical Islam. And, you know, we organize a protest against them. I mean, he's such, so, like, DeSantis trying to play this off as like, oh, you're just trying to, like, got, you know, it's like a gotcha moment. Like, no, it's not. This is a well-known figure who everybody would associate with these types of views.
Well, he walked right into it then at that point. Because Gillum jumped in and said he has spoken at racist conferences. And this is a Gillum quote. These are not my words. Okay. So here's the quote. "He has spoken at racist conferences. He has accepted a contribution and would not return it from someone who referred to the former president of the United States as a Muslim N-word," which he spelled out. Quote, "Now I'm not calling Mr. DeSantis a racist. I'm simply saying the racists believe he's a racist," unquote. Those are strong words, but he's got some evidence to back it up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that DeSantis' whole campaign has been really been around mobilizing people on the basis of these types of either racist dog whistles or, you know, associations with the far right, you know, such that, you know, even if he isn't going himself to these like extremist conferences, that maybe, you know, the people who do go to them will be energized enough by his campaign, and he's perfectly happy to reap the benefits of that.
I just wanted to close by saying that the latest poll released yesterday shows Gillum up by 5 percentage points. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.